crisis that we're facing. I'll hand over to Lynn Walsh to lead up the discussion.
Okay, thanks, Comrade. Not yet. You haven't heard what I've got to say yet. You might not agree. Yes, as comrades can see, I've given out some notes, which are a kind of skeleton outline of the points that I want to make, and I'll try and follow them, although I tend to sort of deviate, probably. But I just point out that some of the headings towards the end of the notes on state intervention in the crisis and the prospect for capitalism are more appropriate to tomorrow morning's session on the recovery or what kind of recovery. So I'm not going to deal with those in detail today. And the other point is that there's a lot of headings where I won't be able to deal with them in detail. I mean, comrades can feel free to raise issues or ask questions, but I want to try to concentrate on the heading of the session, which is the roots of the crisis. What is the origin of this crisis? Where has it arisen from, and what implications does that have for the next period? Now, as Ted said, we are clearly in an economic crisis, and even though there is some signs of it levelling out a bit in some of the main economies, that there's still rising unemployment. The majority of workers will feel the effects of crisis for much longer, even as growth picks up again. And also, while there's so-called fiscal stimulus at the moment to try to cushion the effects of crisis, that the workers will pay for that in the following few years, because it's going to result, obviously, in massive deficits. And capitalist governments of whatever brand are going to try to reduce those deficits through cutting back on social expenditure, on public sector jobs, and also through indirect means, probably, of imposing increased tax burdens on the working class. Now, this crisis is clearly the worst crisis since the 1930s. It's not as deep in many ways. It hasn't led to a collapse of the finance system for a number of reasons, but it is the most extensive crisis. It is a truly globalized crisis that has affected every part of the world. And under modern conditions, the kind of falls in production and loss of output that has taken place over the last 2 or 3 years and may continue in some countries has a very severe impact politically on the working class, and also creates problems for the capitalist class. Now, this crisis began, unusually for a capitalist crisis, as a crisis of the banking system. We tend to say finance system, but it was strictly speaking the banking system itself, which is the core of the finance system, for reasons that I'll come to in a minute. And then it spread to the so-called real economy through the credit squeeze. The shortage of credit led to a seizing up of production, of new production, of trade, of consumption, because people couldn't afford to buy things, and there was a kind of spiral that rebounded back onto the finance sector, making it even a more severe crisis, and then once again rebounding on production of goods and services. We also have to recognise that this is a massive blow to capitalism, and we can say, although this is obviously a subject for other discussions, that if there was some kind of workers' party or left party at the present time that on a mass basis could explain the roots of this crisis in the contradictions of capitalism, the responsibility, not just of capitalist governments, but of the capitalist class itself, that would have a dramatic effect on the consciousness and the movement of vast numbers of workers. And to some extent, the capitalists have been extremely fortunate, if you like, in not facing any serious opposition and being able to carry out the kind of crisis policies that they're carrying out at the present time. Now, in order to analyse crisis, particularly from the point of view of its roots, I've suggested that there's different levels of analysis. And what on there's obviously a level which I don't mention directly here, which is the basic level, if you like, of the inner contradictions of capitalism, and I'll touch on that a bit later. But the ones that I'm mainly concerned with initially are what phase of capitalism are we talking about? What is the kind of structure of capitalism in the current period? What are the international economic relations that are developed in this phase of capitalism? And what does that mean for the crisis? And on the other hand, more immediately, there's what we would refer to as the conjuncture, the immediate situation of the crisis that erupted in 2007 and is still continuing at the present time. Now, in the there's a lot of discussion, and there's almost every day there's a new book on the collapse of Lehman's or or why there was a financial crisis. And there was one reviewed more or less on the radio the other day, where the journalist gives a blow-by-blow account of how Lehman's collapsed, how Barclays refused to bail them out, and this, that, and the other, which is all very interesting. But it doesn't explain why this huge financial bubble arose and what the underlying logic of the crisis was. And the other thing, it gives the impression, they tend to give the impression that it's something like bad weather, that it suddenly brews up and you get a dark thundercloud for several years, and that's very bad, but then later it's going to clear away. And it's just a cyclical phenomena, rather than something much more deeply rooted that, in our view, goes back to around the period of 1980, where there was a definitive end of one period and the beginning of a new period. Now, the period that came to an end, which we generally refer to as the post-war upswing, sometimes as a post-war boom, was the growth of the Western capitalist economies from the end of the Second World War in about 1945. I say about because in the US the upswing started during the war in 1940. But that was a period of exceptional growth of capitalism, up until the oil crisis of 1973, and then there was a slump in 74, 75, which marked the end of that upswing. Now, we have to see, and I can only deal with this in a very sketchy way, that was an exceptional period of capitalism, where because the Western imperialism, the US and Britain and other allies of the US were confronted at that time with a rival social system in the form of Stalinism, of the Stalinist system in the Soviet Union and Central Europe, they were forced to make big concessions to the working class in the form of social expenditure, the so-called welfare state, of a certain element of redistribution through the tax system. And it actually had a very beneficial effect at that time for capitalism, in the sense that the high wages led to high levels of demand and consumption. It promoted consistently high investment, and there was new technology available to raise productivity and both expand production, but also raise its intensity, its level of productivity. But like all periods of capitalism, it came to an end. What was favourable in one period gradually reversed itself. And after around 1965 or 1968, depending which country you're referring to, there began to be a decline of profits. That there was a position where increased investment no longer produced the kind of increased profits that the capitalist class demanded. And that was the beginnings of what I'll explain a bit more in a minute. We regard as a crisis of overaccumulation, where capitalism has reached the point, or the accumulation of capital has reached the point where it can no longer produce the profit returns that are demanded by the capitalist class. Now, this is a very sketchy history. But then there was a period after that where the capitalist class faced a period of international turmoil. There was inflation. There was also low growth, so it gave rise to what was termed stagflation, of an unusual combination of very low growth combined with very high inflation. It was very largely due to the international money system, and particularly the dominant position of the US, which was using deficit spending to finance the Vietnam War and other overseas expenditure. And the capitalist class was forced to reassess its position, and then they turned, to cut a long story short, they turned in 1979, 1980, to a new policy, which was at that time termed monetarism. And Paul Volcker, who was the head of the Federal Reserve Bank in the US at that time, and the strategists of the capitalist class determined that they were going to squeeze out inflation by hiking up interest rates to very high levels. And in other words, it made it very painful and expensive for anyone who owed money, because the debt suddenly became much more burdensome in real terms. And on the other hand, it became extremely good for anybody who had hordes of cash or hordes of financial assets, like who? Bankers, the super rich, big financial institutions, and some big corporations who also hoarded money. Now, this was a marked turn from the conditions of the post-war upswing. And it also marked what has dominated the last period since 1980 in various ways, not with going through several various stages, but since 1980, to pick on a fairly useful date, the world capitalism has been dominated by the financial sector. It began to grow, and then it actually became completely dominant in the period, as we've seen, of since 2000, 2001, where it's grown to a grotesque extent. And that is really the underlying root, if you like, of the character of the current crisis in the economy. Now, I give some periods which you don't need to go into too much, but after 1980, up really until, well, I say 2008, but it obviously didn't come to a complete end last year. There's still strong elements of neoliberalism and globalization, but we refer to it as neoliberalism, which means a return to free market economics. The idea that, for instance, Greenspan in the Federal Reserve particularly promoted, that the market solved all problems. And we also refer to globalization, which is a very loosely used term, but it refers to the intensified integration of the world market of capitalism. Capitalism, since its very beginning, has operated on a global scale, but obviously it's grown in significance in a big way. Could someone, is it all right? Yeah, okay. So, as I mentioned, the globalization, not globalization, but the maybe what we should term financialization, the growing domination of finance capital, the growing integration of the world market, the intensification of neoliberal policies, which didn't just happen, but were actually imposed globally, partly through the pressure of financial markets, but also through agencies like the IMF, the World Bank, OECD, etc. But that went through a series of stages, which I've noted. And that what we can say is, in summary, is that after each crisis, the solution of the capitalist class was to pump in more liquidity. That means they made available more capital, more money in the national and the international economies in order to compensate for a crash either on the stock exchange, as in 1987 when there was a massive stock exchange crash, or in 1997, for instance, there was a crisis of a at that time a massive hedge fund, long-term capital management, which, because of its interconnections with the banking system, threatened a catastrophic meltdown, and the Federal Reserve pressured other big banks to club together to bail them out, and Greenspan at that time pumped in more money. There was the collapse of the so-called dot-com boom, the bubble in technology shares in early 2001, and then after the attacks on the Twin Towers and the Pentagon in 2001, there was a slump on the US and other world stock exchanges, and then that led to a massive injection of funds, of interest rates being brought down effectively to near zero if you take into account inflation, and also unleashing the money supply, where money supply was growing by 20% a year in some cases in the US, which was a phenomenal flood of credit. Now, some commentators now, and again, if you read quite a lot of books and articles at the present time, that Greenspan used to be, you know, God, the biggest guru of economics and finance and so on, that he was credited with, one miraculous powers, really, because the capitalists themselves, in a way, couldn't believe that the crisis was postponed for so long. And I know some comrades used to question us and say, you say, well, the bubble's going to burst, but when is it going to burst? And then there's another year, another year, another year. But it was actually on the basis of this phenomenal expansion of credit that came to an end in 2007 to 2008. Now, there are lots of capitalist commentators now, particularly journalists in the serious financial press, who blame Greenspan and the central bankers, and they say, well, it was irresponsible. They allowed a bubble in asset prices, particularly housing in the recent period, but also in shares and commodities, whatever could be speculated on global markets. But and they also, they allowed interest rates to remain far too long, so money was dirt cheap, particularly for the big financial institutions. And they also allowed, as I mentioned, a very loose money supply. So any of these big corporations could get massive amounts of money to speculate across the world in whatever it was they wanted to speculate in. And we all also know that consumers could speculate, because that was linked to the so-called subprime housing boom, which existed in Britain in many ways, as well as in the United States, in Spain, in Ireland, and so on, and where banks or building societies persuaded people or promoted the idea that almost anyone could buy a house regardless of their income and their real ability to pay. And there was the phenomena of every week almost you get a letter from some other bank offering you another credit card on not necessarily favourable terms, but easy to obtain, if you like, but maybe hard to get out of once you run up debts on it. Now, this has been blamed for the crisis, but in from a Marxist point of view, this is only a superficial explanation, because you have to say, well, where does the money come from? Now, I know some people think, well, banks or whoever can, central banks can print money at will. Now, if they simply did that, it would obviously be highly inflationary under most circumstances. So you've got to identify some real source of this money. It can't be simply the idea that the central bank unleashes the sluice gates and it all comes pouring out, and that solves the problem. Because on that basis, capitalism could go on forever. You know, what would be the problem? You just print more and more money. Now, on the point 8 in the handout, it gives a brief summary of the sources of the cheap credit. Now, obviously, we start from the position that loose money facilitated by the central banks was the facilitating process, if you like. That had to happen. If they'd have adopted a more tight position with higher interest rates and tighter money, although it's questionable how they could have enforced it, but they could have restricted it more than they did. Now, the actual real sources, if you like, are given as excess One of them is excess corporate profits. Now you might think, well, what are excess corporate profits? That maybe all corporate profits are excess. But what I actually mean by that is that it's their excess profits in the extent that they've raised their level of product profitability, which happened across the world for a period in the 1980s, and then again in the 1990s, and then again in the early part of this century, by intensifying the exploitation of workers through cutbacks, you know, casualization of labor, intensification of the labor process and so on. But on the other hand, their capital investment, their investment in new means of production, is actually being historically on a very low level. And it's roughly speaking, in the 90s, it was only running at half the level that it ran in the 1960s, even though you had the industrialization of areas like China, of other underdeveloped or semi-developed countries and so on. So even in spite of what looks like phenomenal investment in some sectors of the world economy, capital investment, and that means new investment minus the worn-out capital, so it's net capital accumulation, is being only half the rate of the period of the post-war upswing. So where's the extra profit gone? And the answer is it's gone into financial speculation. It hasn't gone into developing the means of production, or, you know, building houses or socially useful infrastructure in the last period. But there are some other reserve sources. One is the foreign exchange reserves of countries like China, which has a big export, for a long time had a big export surplus, so that translates into an accumulation of foreign currency reserves. The same applies to many of the oil producers. Japan has been overtaken by China now as a surplus country, but they accumulated huge surpluses. Now, those are huge piles of money that weren't imported into the Chinese or the Japanese economy, because that, again, they had limited internal domestic growth. To simply import the money into yen or RMB, etc., in China would have been inflationary by itself. So they kept the money in their cash accounts, and by and large, they kept it. In the case of China, they bought up U.S. Treasury bonds, so they're actually financing the trade deficit of the U.S., the federal government deficit, and also a lot of private debt as well. And the same applies to the oil producers. So that's a very contradictory relationship, where it's really the capital flows that determine the trade relations, and not the other way around. And then there's another source, which is the savings of people in particularly in many of the Asian countries, and that's because the level of social provision is low. It has been low historically, so people save more than in the West for their retirement, for health, for education, and so on, because there's very limited or very little state provision. Now those savings are in many cases. The classic case was Japan, for instance. They were deposited in the post office savings bank. The people were paid really a low rate of interest. The post office lent it to investment banks or other big international banks. They lent it to speculators on the world arena at what amounted to very low interest rates. So that was another source of huge liquidity into the world, into the world economy. And it represents, if you like, debt finance consumption in countries of Europe, the US and so on, and on the other hand, high levels of growth of production in countries like China, but on the basis of very low domestic living standards and very limited growth of the internal market. So that explains where this huge flood of money came from, and why the big banks could apparently speculate with some hiccups and crises, as in 2001 and so on, and earlier in 1990-1991. But they felt themselves to be immune. They thought, well, never mind, we have a crisis, but the Federal Reserve lowers interest rates. So they went, of course, when you get to zero, it's a bit difficult. And then they resort to pumping money in, as they're doing at the present time. Now, just to give you one or a couple of very brief figures on the domination of the finance sector, if I can find it. These figures vary slightly because they're depending on whose estimates that you use. But from 1973 to 1985, it's estimated that the financial sector, this is in the US, accounted for around 16% of domestic corporate profit, 16%. But by 86, this had gone up to 19%. That's not a very big increase. But by the 1990s, it went up to between 21 and 30%, depending on which years you take. And by the end of the 1990s, it had reached 41%. That means 41% of the total corporate profits in the US were eaten up, if you like, or grabbed by the finance sector. And of course, that is why they were paying these huge bonuses to the top bankers. And, you know, the real question is, it's bad enough that they're paid these grotesque amounts for really wrecking the economy. But on the other hand, you have to ask, well, why are they able to do this? And it's rooted in this domination of the financial sector. It's not, and that's the real basis of the problem. And the role of the finance sector, or the effect on the economy, one is that it maximizes short-term profit, because they are speculating in shares or company bonds or whatever. So the only thing they're interested in is the results at the end of the quarter. It used to be a year, then it was down to a half year, and in the recent period it's been quarterly. So if the profits go down, then they start selling off the shares, and you know the companies come under pressure to be taken over or restructured or things like that. And then the other thing is that they concentrate profit. They're not necessarily, or mostly they're not, creating new profit in a global way from the point of view of the capitalist class as a whole, but they're concentrating the profit more and more into the hands of the top layer, and it's about 0.1% that is accounted for most of this growth in profitability through the capital gains on shares, on bonds and so on, and on the kind of bonuses and benefits that they've got as a result of their activity. Now, some of the other things I mentioned as features of the last period are I'm not going to go into. I mentioned free trade, for instance, which is an important issue, but it's really, from the point of view we're discussing today, a mechanism. It's the fact that it sort of institutionalizes. It's a mechanism which institutionalizes the domination of the most powerful capitalist countries, particularly the US, but also Japan and Europe. And it's actually accelerated the unequal distribution of wealth, both within countries, but also between countries, which have grown enormously in the last period. And obviously this is a factor that in the general sense produces crisis, because it lowers the share of the income taken by the majority of the population, which means that the demand for goods and services is obviously undermined. And we can see that in particular in the US, where since 1980, most of the time there was a complete stagnation of real incomes or earned income for the majority of people. And then for a number of periods in the 90s, there was actually a decline. I don't know what the latest up-to-date figure is. It probably shows a decline over the last 5 years. But that was almost all compensated for by debt, by taking money out of housing. When the value of houses went up, the people extended their mortgages and siphoned off some of the value of the houses into consumer spending or health spending or education or whatever, but it meant that the whole basis of consumption, which as far as the US was concerned was a vitally important feature of the whole world economy, and China and other producers depended on it, was based on debt, which, as I mentioned, was in many ways financed by the surplus exporters of goods anyway. Now, the actual, I do have a section which refers to the relationship between China, section 11, the US-China axis, which is, I'd say, is the pivot of globalized capitalism in the past period. Now, I have sort of touched on that already, but I think what that refers to is that was the almost the dynamo at the center of the world economy in the 1990s, from about 1994, when globalization and the China-US trade accelerated. And that was, if you like, an interlocking, partnership's the wrong word, but relationship, where they as I mentioned, that the China produced cheap goods, or cheaper goods than could be produced in the advanced capitalist countries. On the other hand, they that was done on the basis of very low living standards in China, although they actually come up for some sections, and there is an emergence of a certain middle class in China, but a small minority strata of the population. And on the other hand, China was forced, really, to, out of self-interest, to finance the deficits of the US in order to sustain the market. On the other hand, this external, international imbalance was translated into an internal imbalance. So you got the position in the US of deindustrialization, large sectors of industry being wiped out in the late 80s and 90s, lower wages, casualization of labor, reliance on very cheap, intensively exploited immigrant labor, and, as I mentioned, the huge volumes of debt, which kept the whole thing going. And that is now beginning to unwind because it's become unsustainable. Now, the economic crisis of 2007 and following 2007, as I mentioned, was in the immediate terms triggered by the financial crisis. Now, that means the collapse of the banking system that began with the subprime mortgage collapse that spread to other sections of the banking system was the trigger. Now, as I've tried to show, that was rooted into a much longer term, deeper trend in capitalism. But but if we look at it from the point of view of the immediate crisis or the conjuncture of capitalism, it was the finance sector that triggered it. And for instance, Marx in the 19th century referred to exceptional occasions when this would happen. That it was usually the other way around, that a decline in production or a sudden development of overproduction then leading to a slump or a downturn for, you know, various reasons in the real economy then led to a financial crisis. This was the other way around. And what had happened is that the whole edifice of credit had become so overblown and so contradictory that it, in effect, collapsed under its own weight. Now, obviously, there are specific features. You know, you can say that the policies of various investment banks, the policies of big mortgage lenders like Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac in the US and some of the big mortgage lenders in Britain all contributed to the situation. But basically, they were a product of this dominance of finance capital and this massive reliance on credit and manipulation of credit. Now, the first thing that bankers used to learn in the good old days, whenever they were, is that the main problem with banking was assessing credit risk. So bankers who wanted to survive and make money used to check out their customers or borrowers and you know, check their credit worthiness, their income, their assets, their credit record and so on and so forth. But of course all that tended to go by the board in the late 90s and the early part of this century. But the financiers thought, well, no problem, because we've got ways of dealing with this, and they invented these things called credit derivatives, which were supposed to abolish risk. Now, a derivative is basically a contract. In the past, they were used for things like commodities, like wheat or oil, and they allowed people who wanted oil or wheat or whatever next year or 2 years' time to actually contract to buy it at a future date at a set price. So it eliminated, it was a gamble, but it eliminated the risk. They knew how much they were going to have to pay in a year's time or 2 years' time. But that, then we got the removal or the step up of the credit to the derivative from real commodities, where the underlying, the derivative is called derivative because its value is derived from the underlying asset. Well, the underlying asset was originally, as I said, a commodity, or it could be a building or whatever. But then they developed a new layer of derivatives that were related to financial assets, like, for instance, mortgages. And that's where the subprime crisis came in, because they packaged, the mortgages were not just one customer, one bank, or one building society, but banks and building societies and various other agencies would take out mortgages, but then they would sell them on to investment banks or other institutions. They would chop them all up into little pieces and bundle them up into bundles. This is, you know, a simplified version, obviously, but it's basically what happened. And the idea was that if one or the other or one group of borrowers defaulted, then it wouldn't really matter, because there were so many others who wouldn't default at that time, that they you know, it would balance itself out. So they almost convinced themselves that they'd abolish risk, that there was no more risk in lending money. So all these mortgages, which were, for instance, in the US, they started in cities like Detroit, which is one of the poorest cities in Detroit, with, you know, historic high levels of unemployment. And they deliberately went out to sell these subprime mortgages to people in those areas. And it wasn't an accident. They actually needed those mortgages, because as they were high risk, they also bore a high interest rate. So they provided the high interest rate component of these packages of mortgages. Now, if somebody was a surefire borrower who, you know, had good assets and a good credit record, they wouldn't attract such a high interest rate, because there's no there's very little risk attached to them anyway. So they actually promoted risky loans in order to push up the interest rates on the grounds that it would all be cancelled out by the mix in these packages of credit derivatives. And then they had other forms of derivatives, like so-called credit default swaps, which are very complex things, but they basically were supposed to act as some kind of insurance. So if people or borrowers defaulted, then from the pool of the people buying these default swaps, they would be paid out. So it would act like a kind of insurance fund for the investors. But instead of abolishing the risk involved, it actually turned out to maximize it, because what they found is, at the end of 2007, is that the so-called toxic elements, the elements that had defaulted and were no longer producing any money, had become so mixed in with all the rest that nobody knew what was contaminated or not. They didn't know whether the bundle was good, or there was a 10% bad element or 20% bad element. So no one was buying them. And then the people who bought these derivatives on the basis of credit had their creditors demanding that they pay back their money, because they were worried that they no longer had any assets and so on. So basically it was like a bank run, except it wasn't like the bank run of Northern Rock, where people are sitting outside, or the chairman of Gloucester, where the local savers are sitting outside the bank demanding their money. But it was like a much bigger bank run of the big investment banks, all demanding from one another that they all return their loans or cough up their collateral or whatever. And that is what led to the meltdown and the virtual disappearance of all the major investment banks. They were the dominant form of the finance sector for 15 or 20 years. And then after 2007, 2008, and the collapse of Lehman's, they've all been bought up by the big major banks. There's no independent investment banks now, and that shows the extent of the collapse. Now, as I mentioned at the outset, the crisis of the banking sector led to a credit squeeze, so the banks were no longer willing to lend to anybody, even one another, and the so-called interbank lending network, which was previously been used for the banks to lend to one another to cover their day-to-day business, completely seized up. Companies couldn't get loans, house buyers couldn't get loans, or found it very difficult to get loans. Trade credits seized up, which actually aggravated the slump in world trade. It was mainly due to the drop in demand, but was aggravated by the lack of credit. And then, of course, when that produced sort of bankruptcies or credit or defaults on loans within the housing sector or the business sector, and that actually made the position for the banks worse. So we got the position where there were huge losses, and most of the major banks were, not all of them, but the majority, were actually, strictly speaking, insolvent, which is a polite way of saying bankrupt, and had to be rescued by the government, in some cases through nationalisation or at least substantial partial nationalisation. There were other measures taken. Now, I'm going to conclude more or less on that point, because as I said, some of the other issues of the next period will come in tomorrow's session. But I think we do have to note that the crisis, although it's the worst crisis since 1929-33, hasn't resulted in the kind of catastrophic collapse that took place at that time. And I think that's mainly, or we should say yes, because it's mainly due to the intervention of the major capital states and also China, where on the one side they bailed out the banks, which they didn't do in 1929-33. They learned the lesson of that. They allowed them to collapse and only tried to stabilise them when it was too late. And they probably, according to the OECD, they pumped in roughly $20 trillion. I don't know how you can imagine such amount of money, but in terms of subsidies, takeovers, injections of capital, guarantees of loans of banks and so on, $20 trillion, and that is what has stabilised the economy. They've also pumped in money through printing money, through the so-called quantitative easing, which is not directly inflationary at the moment because of the fact that banks are actually sitting on huge hoards of money, and it's not actually going through into the economy. And also, of course, they've carried out the so-called fiscal stimulus packages, which are not as big as the bank bailout. I think the figure, again, given by the OECD, which is an estimate, is of the G20 countries that they have spent, or they have initiated, they're not fully, this is over 2 years by and large, they've initiated fiscal stimulus packages of 1.9 trillion, that's about 1.7% of the GDP of the G20. And of course the biggest stimulus has come in the US, and on the other hand in China, where a large part of the stimulus has been on infrastructure projects which have been implemented very, very quickly. Now, it's too soon to say, obviously, what the results will be. We can see some of the features of recovery, but it's clear that many of the relationships that sustain capitalism in the last 20 or 30 years are not simply going to carry on. They can't continue on the basis of this flood of credit. Where does it come from? How will it be managed? They can't sustain indefinitely the huge contradiction between the deficit countries, the creditor countries like China, Japan, etc., and on the other hand, the deficit countries and the debtor countries like the US, Britain, and others. With trade, capitalism is avoided the collapse of trade and the introduction of strong protectionist measures of the sort that happened in the 1930s. But there is a kind of what the Lamy, the head of the World Trade Organization, calls low-intensity warfare in relation to guerrilla action, if you like, of trying to restrict imports or retaliate with countermeasures. And that's particularly noticeable between China and the US, despite the fact that they're so heavily dependent on each other. So I think in conclusion we can say that it is the end of the era. It's not to say that there's going to be a very rapid transformation into a new structure. We saw after the end of the post-war upswing, it took at least from 1974-75 up until 79, when there was a period of intense disarray within the strategists of the capitalist class, that they didn't have a solution. They strove to find a way out of the crisis, and that is even more the case at the present time, where they really have almost no idea of how they're going to resolve the problems that they're simply muddling through. And we can say that unrestrained globalization and unrestrained neoliberalism is being checked, and it can't continue on exactly the same basis as in the last 20 years. And we can see that from the way the capitalist state is being forced to intervene, to nationalize, to bail out the banks, to adopt a much more interventionist position on the economy than they had previously, where they, under Greenspan or particularly the leaders in the US, they'd in effect declared that the market was the only, if not the more or less perfect mechanism for running the economy. And clearly that idea has been completely shattered.